Torpy always spoke of himself in the third person.
Mr. Nair is here, looking for that dame what started the trouble.
I told him he was free to look wherever he liked. Claire, dressed like a man, sat on the porch, bold as brass, playing cards with Jimmy and the princess. Mr. Schneiderman sat next to them, kibitzing. Looking through every room, Claire kept her few clothes in a bolded valise Jimmy had lent her. Torpy galumped out to the porch. Mom and I followed close behind.
I never seen this dame, said Torpy, but I got a good idea of her puss. There's drawings of her in the station house.
Anyone else living here?
Just us, I replied, as well as the prof. But you know him from the seances.
Yeah,
Torpy snorted as he studied the card players.
I can see she ain't here, but I know a new face when I see one, he said, pointing at Claire. What's your name?
Voltaire.
How come you got a dame's voice?
Before Claire could answer, the princess cut in.
Monsieur Voltaire is a world-famous medium who lives in the best of all possible worlds. His spirit guide is the Indian princess Pococurante, sister of Pocahontas. It's her voice that you're hearing. If you want to know where your cousin Merton has hidden the money, just ask Monsieur Voltaire.
Really? A delighted Torpy exclaimed. Claire, just like the princess, closed her eyes and seemed to take off for dreamland. Speaking in her own voice, she said,
Your cousin Merton from
Hamilton,
Torpy rushed in to answer.
He lived with his mother, my Aunt Bertha.
In Bertha's
grandfather's house.
The money?
Yes, Torpy eagerly asked.
Was this the moment Claire would be caught?
Cash and,
answered Claire, obviously trying to stall.
Stock certificates, said Torpy. How much in all?
10,000 at least.
Where'd he bury the metal box?
The one place you forgot.
Under the porch. It's there, ain't it?
I, Pococurante, have spoken. Torpy bounded off the porch and out the screen door, yelling,
Dang it, I'm gonna be rich.
Lucky that he had said Hamilton and not some city nearby. The events of the day and the distance had bought us time. Our canaries, chirping merrily, seemed to agree. But sending Torpy off on a wild goose chase was one thing, avoiding detection for several more days, quite another. Police cars were still patrolling Carmel, so I went down the road to the phone box and rang AR. He wanted to know whether I was calling from home. As soon as I told him no, his voice softened. I said that I had to get a friend out of town and needed some help. Reminding me he didn't distribute free meals, he promised to send Legs Diamond to Carmel. Then I mentioned that Claire was an anarchist.
Sorry, can't do.
Why not?
They're radicals.
And you're not?
I don't want a country without laws.
You break them every day, I replied, astonished that he of all people would care about order.
Without laws, you can't break them. In my business, money comes from beating the system. Take away the system, and where are you?
Broke. Not knowing what else to say, I asked about my own case.
I told you, as soon as the judge decides, I'll get word to you, but not by phone.
What's taking Fallon so long?
He's too much with the dames.
Now, on my own, Ben, the princess, and I concocted a plan to spirit her away in a coffin. We would have the Vineland undertaker drive our wooden box, with Claire hidden inside, to the town of Elmer, where she could board the West Jersey Railroad for Philly. But even the best laid plans.
Ben took his time building the coffin, waiting for the cops to slacken their search.
In the meantime, we gold-bricked. As soon as the morning heat had burned off the dew, we'd bicycle to the Morris River and wrestle in the sand. Afterwards, we swam and rafted on logs that the weekend swimmers had lashed together with wire. It was our own Mississippi, idyllic, except for the blue dye in the water that tinted the skin. The factory was dumping again. Each day was unforgettable, and yet the same. "I bet I can pin you," Ben would say. "Bet you can't," I would answer. Agile, I could squirm loose from most of his holds, except for a body press. The weight difference between us made it impossible for me to get free. Once he had me down, he'd cover my face with kisses, which he said were his guerdon, a 10-cent word he'd read in some book of medieval tales. I said, "No fair," and he'd reply, "Say uncle," but I wouldn't give in, not until his kisses grew heated, and I'd say, "Time out," and he would release me. I'd pretend to walk off, but actually come up behind him, winding my arms around his neck and hitching a ride on his back as we laughed and laughed till tears salted our faces. If we wrestled in the morning, it was at Ben's place, where the dewy grass soaked our clothes. But in the afternoon, the sun-dried grass made it scratchy. Later, he'd carry me to his tar-papered shack, where we sat at the kitchen table talking about the books or essays we'd read. It was a time when there was no time, at least not to us, who counted life by the time spent together. The coffin finished, we pulled it ourselves to the farm on a neighbor's rubber-wheeled cart. Ben had anticipated all the necessities, having drilled small air holes in the sides and padded the bottom with an old army mattress. Meantime, the princess and the prof were spatting, but this time it touched upon Birdie. Some disagreement had arisen between them concerning the outdoor seance to take place July 3rd. Apparently, the prof wanted her to materialize more than the usual number of things. He was suggesting an American flag, a small bronzed golden eagle, a miniature White House, and a pocket-sized phosphorescent Jesus. The princess, particularly agitated, kept saying, "No." "Before your nerves get the better of you," soothed the prof, "remember how resourceful I can be." She exclaimed, "It's my body." "You're jumping to conclusions. All I said was that most people prefer symbols to thought. They want to feel good. They're not interested in news from the spirit world unless it bears out their biases." "There just isn't room. If you want to have ectoplasm in the form of a hand and a harmonica, as well as a horn, you'll have to forego the symbolic stuff and let Henrietta hide the bird and the concertina inside her clothes. That increases the risk of discovery she's not a genuine." "And you're convinced that I am?" "Absolutely." "Then why do you have me perform these carnival tricks?" "To silence the skeptics. Magic detracts. People expect it." "And you, what do you expect?" "That one day the scientific community will kneel down to you for proving that there is a world yet to come." "And to that end, you are willing to risk everything." Although I had a glimmering of what they were saying, some of it left me confused. It wasn't until later that the princess lifted the veil of unknowing. The next day, Sunday, June the 25th, was set for Claire's coffin escape. All our plans were in place. Shortly before 12, Claire would climb into the box. The undertaker, Mr. Bluto, was told to arrive promptly at noon to pick up the coffin and three mourners, Ben, the princess, and me. Taking into account the dirt roads and the frequency of flat tires, we allowed 2 hours for the trip up to Elmer. If the train was on time, Claire would be steaming out of the station on the 4:22 for Philly. Every sign appeared in our favor, including the most unlikely of all. Torpy had taken the train from Bridgeton to Hamilton and found, under the porch, a metal box with various forms of legal tender. Though the amount was less than Claire had predicted, Torpy benignly concluded that either his cousin Ferd had arrived there before him and grabbed a few G's, or that Poco Curantis Arithmetic had somehow gotten garbled. The next morning, we all gathered in the dining room with high expectations. Just before 12, Ben nailed down the lid on Claire, some food, and 2 jugs of water. Noon came and went. Shortly before 1, Claire whispered she had cramps and needed a bathroom. Ben opened the lid. While she was easing her pains, Mr. Bluetoe drove up in his hearse.
"Where's the body?"
he asked, standing just outside the screen door. "You were expected at noon," Ben said.
"Didn't want to miss the morning prayer session at our church. Besides, your Uncle Stanislaus ain't going nowhere."
Stalling for time, I asked Mr. Bluto to share with us the sweet prayers he'd heard at the breakfast. I nearly gagged on my insincerity, but I was learning that if you're going to survive in this world, you have to know how to talk mush.
"The Lord was with us. You could feel it. We praised him and damned to hellfire all the foreigners in America."
"Sounds like a full day's work in one morning," said Ben.
"We're letting in too many foreigners," Mr. Bluto complained. "We ought to send them back where they came from."
"When your grandfather came to America," I wickedly asked, "did he speak English?"
"Hell no," answered Mr. Bluto indignantly. "He spoke Bulgarian."
"Lucky they didn't send him back, or right now you might be farming some rocky hillside, working as a serf."
Mr. Bluto's face reddened.
"Where's the damn body?" he snapped.
"We'll just go inside and say one more prayer over dear Uncle Stanislaus," I said, "and then you can have his remains." Ben and I went inside while the princess entertained Mr. Bluto. Claire was still indisposed. I whispered through the door that the undertaker was waiting outside. She groaned that the tank was just about empty and she'd be out in a sec. But Mr. Bluto reached the dining room before Claire. Seeing the empty coffin, he asked what in blazes was going on. I told him that we were just giving Uncle Stanislaus a last washing up because we didn't want him facing eternity with egg on his face.
"Well, where is he if you're here?" asked Mr. Bluto.
"Drying off," I said. "We'll get him." Ben and I went to the bathroom. Claire was just coming out. Ben told her to act as if rigor mortis had set in and to make herself stiff as a board. Then we carried her into the dining room and laid her out in the coffin. Peering into the coffin, Mr. Bluto exclaimed,
"That ain't no man, that's a woman. And danged if she don't look like someone I've seen someplace before."
He then turned on his heels and left, no doubt to report what he'd seen. Claire rightly suspected we'd not seen the last of Mr. Bluto. In fact, the very next day, Torpy drove up and asked for a powwow. Mom, having seen a police car wheel into the drive, had bustled Claire off to the bedroom to don her disguise.
"The Vineland police called us in Bridgeton to let us know they was coming this way," Torpy explained. "I don't know how many, but some undertaker's been saying that Clairvoyant might be hiding out here."
"Here?" I exclaimed. "Why would Mr. Bluto think that?"
"Let's put our cards on the table," Torpy said. "That man who was a woman, you know, the one which told me where the money was hid. If he, I mean she, is the anarchist they're looking for, I'm warning you, look out. She, he, whatever, done me a favor. Now I'm showing that person my thanks, even though I'm a cop."
From behind us, Claire's voice rang out.
"I've long held," she proclaimed, "that the working man of America is fundamentally fair. Torpy, you're a good fellow. If you ever need further advice, don't fail to ask."
Torpy's eyes bulged and his mouth opened like a sprung trap door. You could almost feel his amazement. Mumbling something about the roads being unsafe and our calling him if we could use his assistance, he trotted off to his car, patted the hood, and drove off. Jimmy and Mr. Schneiderman had departed for work, but the rest of us fell to arguing about what to do next.
"If we honestly explain to the authorities that Claire has every right in a free country to speak her mind,"
said the prof. I'm sure they'll uphold the law.
Protect us? Scoffed the princess. Not a chance.
Women have no rights, Claire contended. But before she could launch off into one of her speeches, I interrupted.
We need a place to hide.
And not behind legalities, Ben added. That's not what Henny means.
You can leave if you like, said the prof, clearly disgruntled, but I'm staying put.
Then you're staying alone, the princess replied. Weren't you listening? The cops are on their way here.
It's an unholy union, said Ben. The law and the lawman. The prof refused to listen.
I have the utmost confidence that the police will behave in an exemplary manner.
What did that mean, I wondered. The debate had gone on long enough, so I decided to take the bull by the horns.
The woods are the best place to hide, in the swamp. I know some good places. Let's get started.
The prof stubbornly remained in the house. The rest of us, Mom included, took to the woods. Before we'd reached the swamp, we heard in the distance police sirens and the sound of guns going off. We hadn't left a minute too soon. Leading the way, I guided the party through a jungle of laurel and vines to a bog not easily reached. As we sat on the moss and waited, I was reminded of the times that this swamp brought to mind Eden. The darkness, broken only by the croaking of frogs and the splash of a fish, put me at peace. I felt secure, as if my mom were holding me in her arms. On our quaking island, I lost track of the time. Eventually, we heard voices coming our way. I suggested that we push further into the woods, but the others counseled patience. So we waited, which proved a mistake. Before long, we could hear men on three sides of us.
These bog islands is a good place to hide, said one. You take that small one and we'll take the one full of cedars.
Sooner than expected, we heard the splashing of water and the snapping of twigs as the men started to wade through the swamp. Mom whispered to me in Yiddish, asking what they would do if they caught us. I told her not to worry. Leaving my place of concealment, I pushed through the trees and matted undergrowth to the edge of the island, where I let out a holler.
Help! Anyone there? Please save us!
There's one of them, someone shouted in the dark.
Quick, before it's too late, I yelled.
Come out of there, all of yous, and don't try no tricks, ordered the voice.
We can't. We're trapped. We need your help. Hurry.
What's wrong?
Snakes, I cried. Timber rattlers, they're everywhere, in the water, underfoot, in the trees, everywhere.
Timber rattlers, came a startled reply.
As big as logs, I said.
Snakes, bellowed the voice. Rattlers.
From all directions, men shouted.
Look out! What's that? I just seen one. The place is swarming with them. Judas Priest, let's get out of here. Have mercy, I theatrically begged. Don't leave us to die. In the name of the Lord, I beg you.
All you could hear were the sounds of retreat until some redneck yelled,
You got it coming to you, you socialist bastards!
We remained through the night trying to decide what to do about Claire. In men's clothes, she could pass undetected, known only to Mr. Bluto and Torpy. But with the roads in and out of Carmel still blocked, we concluded that the best way to escape was to follow the Indian paths through the woods and wend our way to the Morris River and to the log raft the weekend swimmers had used, the one lashed together with wires. Ben declared that he knew a moonshiner, John Barleycorn, living close by, who could show us which path to take to the river. It was therefore agreed that the princess would lead Mom to the house and that Ben and I would accompany Claire to the far side of Millville, from which point she could float safely down to the Delaware Bay. The only problem would be her having to pass right through Millville.